You're tuned to Perspectives, a weekly public affairs show which airs every Saturday right here on KTEP. Joining us today on our KTEP book club is Dr. Brendan Riley. Dr. Riley is the author of the book One Doctor, Close Calls, Cold Cases, and the Mysteries of Medicine. Brendan, thank you very much for being with us here today.
My pleasure.
Now, your book, One Doctor, Close Calls, Cold Cases, and the Mysteries of Medicine, it has a very interesting cover because it has some dice. And I guess, is that cover kind of implying that in medicine you sometimes have to roll the dice?
There's a little bit of that. There's also the idea that in medicine today, everything is very super specialized. So if you notice on the cover of the book, these blocks have different body organs on them, like one has a heart and one has a kidney, that kind of thing. And yet at the top of the pile of blocks is the number one. And one of the major themes of the book is that it's great to be able to use the expertise of specialists and super specialists who are great at one part of the body or one disease. But I think it's pretty important that sick patients also have one doctor who really knows them well as a person, who can kind of tie things all together. And unfortunately, sometimes in our healthcare system, folks can fall through the cracks because they're bouncing back and forth from one specialist to another.
We are visiting with Dr. Brendan Riley. Dr. Riley is the author of the book One Doctor, Close Calls, Cold Cases, and the Mysteries of Medicine. The book alternates between two time frames. The first, I believe, is a two-week period in 2010, during which Dr. Riley served as the attending physician at the head of a team, and that was at New York Presbyterian Hospital. And the second part of the book takes place during a quarter century earlier, when most of the doctor's time was spent as a primary care physician at Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center in New Hampshire. But regardless, you take us through a very unique trip, doctor, as far as guiding us through what goes on through your mind, what is going on through the patient's mind, the relatives, and all the deals you have to deal with. And you start off where you're going to the hospital. It's a Saturday. And, well, I'll let you take us from there.
Well, it's interesting that you ask about it in that way, because I did write the book because I thought for a long time in my dealings with folks I help take care of and their families, I thought that it would be useful if patients knew a little bit more about what doctors do and how they go about trying to help patients in an increasingly complex medical care system, especially doctors like me who take care of patients who are quite sick in the hospital. And many of them are also older folks who are dealing not just with a particular sickness, but all the, you know, the disabilities and the anxieties about getting older. And so I had wanted for a long time to write about that, but the experiences that you mentioned during just a couple of weeks during my time working as an attending physician at a big teaching hospital in New York, that was really the stimulus for me to actually sit down and start writing this thing, because what happened during those couple of weeks, not just with the patients I was taking care of in the hospital, but with my own parents. My mother and father were both in their 90s, and they were dealing with a lot of difficult health issues too. And when I actually had a chance to sit back and think about, what just happened there in those last 2 weeks, I thought telling the story of those 2 weeks might help, readers understand a little bit better some of the things that I think are important.
I'm glad you mentioned your parents there, because a lot of people would find it very difficult to do what you're doing. First of all, they know, those who have been caregivers know how difficult it is. And many times we go to a patient and we'll say, how are you doing? How do you feel? Not realizing that the caregiver is probably just as exhausted, and he needs attention as well. You are teaching students, you're a practicing physician, and at the same time, you're taking care of your parents.
I'm sure you know, most doctors would tell you it's never a good idea to try to be the doctor to your own family. And it's kind of an interesting phenomenon. On the one hand, you want to help your family members as best you can, but on the other hand, if you're going to be a good doctor, you have to be able to achieve some kind of objectivity about what's happening and what's the best thing to do. And I think that's pretty much impossible to do when you're taking care of your own loved ones. In my case, as the book mentions, I didn't have a whole lot of choice. My parents lived in a place where there were no doctors. I was it, so I didn't have much choice.
They knew the fact that you were going through, and of course your colleagues did as well. But the fact that they lived, as you said, a place where there was no doctor, and in one of the beginning parts of the book, as you're making your rounds, you get a call from, I guess, the caretaker, and they're telling you a little bit about what's going on, and your dad has to go to the hospital, I believe, or your mom?
Yes, that's right. So my mother and father, again, both in their early 90s, my father had had cancer, which had advanced to a point where treatment wasn't really going to do him any good, and interestingly enough, he was a retired physician himself, so he was someone who knew very well what he faced, and he had decided to sort of just do the best he could and see how much time God left him to live and try to enjoy it as best he could. But at the same time, my mother was suffering from dementia, from Alzheimer's disease, and so even though she was physically okay, she wasn't mentally okay. And the two of them together were living in a place where they actually live on an island off the coast of Long Island. And as it happened, there aren't any doctors there. And so along with taking care of elderly parents, which many of your listeners know, if it's not in a nursing home, it means you need folks living with them. And so, yes, we had caregivers with both of my parents trying to attend to their daily needs. But at the same time, my father was facing these tough physical medical issues, and my mother was facing these tough cognitive medical issues.
We are visiting with Dr. Brendan Riley. Dr. Riley is the author of the book, One Doctor, Close Calls, Cold Cases, and the Mysteries of Medicine. Doctor, when you're writing in your book about visiting the patients and making your rounds, and one of the things that I found would be kind of difficult to deal with, the fact is that, okay, you know what's going on, but then there are other doctors around you who have their own ideas, and you're wondering if they're going to see it. And the one that comes to mind is the one where the gentleman doesn't have reflexes because he can't see out of one of his eyes, and you're checking that?
Yeah, again, part of the reason I wrote the book the way I did, including stories from the present as well as stories from the past a long time ago when I was more of a primary care doctor than a hospital doctor, is that medicine has changed dramatically. And in many ways, I think the most important way it's changed is that in the old days, patients tended to have a doctor. The relationship was much more one-on-one. The patient and doctor together decided what to do in particular cases. Now, for all kinds of reasons, patients tend to have a whole team of doctors. And not only do the patients often not know who the team is and what they're all thinking, but as you just mentioned, sometimes the members of the team, the doctors themselves, don't always know what each other is thinking. And so kind of providing the kind of continuity of care that I think patients need, where someone really knows what happened yesterday and what happened a year ago and sometimes even 10 years ago, is real important. And yet in today's medicine, as you probably know many times now, when patients go in the hospital, the doctors taking care of them are not their own doctors, they're new doctors. And so there's a lot of miscommunication that can happen, and that's a big change from the past. And modern medicine is, you know, struggling with this. And I think a lot of people would agree with me that we have a ways to go before we can make this better.
We're visiting with Dr. Brendan Riley. Dr. Riley is the author of One Doctor, Close Calls, Cold Cases, and the Mysteries of Medicine. The book is a narrative written by the doctor, and as you read it, immediately you are transformed into the area of New York City and Boston, and you're going through the hallways that the doctor is going through. You're visiting the patients. You get to know the patients, their spouses, their relatives, and a lot of ins and outs of the book, of medicine, and what you might think, well, perhaps this is what they're doing, this is not what they're doing. When you're talking about treatment, one of the things that fascinated me, too, is the fact that in New York, the 10th floor, I believe, is where you can stay wherever you want to stay, and it's basically almost like a luxury hotel.
Yeah, well, that's not true just in New York. I'm not sure what's happening in El Paso, but there are an awful lot of hospitals around the U.S. who are sort of creating these kind of luxury amenity areas in the hospital where, you know, the rooms are bigger and fancier and have a view and the food is better and the televisions are better and all that stuff. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. I think it's fine to try to make patients more comfortable when they're sick in the hospital. But in most hospitals, this is kind of an extra level of care. It's something that only, in general, you know, well-to-do people get a chance to take advantage of, and of course they have to pay for it. And so it's, again, it's one example of what I think of as the sort of fragmentation within our healthcare system. Not only do some folks around the country not get care at all, on the other end of this, and this is, you know, one subset, I think, of the national problem we're having with, you know, the 1% and the 99%, but even within our own hospitals, you often have a floor or an area that's, you know, for the 1%ers, and then the rest of the hospital is for the 99%ers. And that phenomenon I find fascinating, especially since, you know, of course, being rich doesn't mean you're any different from the rest of us, especially when you get sick and you need help.
What was the situation, and did you encounter many of these, with the couple that's up on that floor, and it seemed like you all wanted to discharge them? They were fine, or it appeared that you did all you could done, and they insisted on staying there?
Yeah, well, actually, in my experience anyway, a very unusual situation. What was happening there was that a patient was actually gaming the system. The patient was making herself sick so that she had to come into the hospital and stay in the hospital. She was fooling her doctors, and she did this for an ulterior purpose. In her case, she was trying to avoid an appearance in court, and the way she could do that was being in the hospital. That kind of gaming of the healthcare system, you know, so blatant and explicit, is rare. It was, I think, an interesting story, but it's not typical. What's a lot more typical is that an awful lot of what's done in healthcare today isn't necessary. There's an awful lot of waste of the resources and the facilities that we have to provide healthcare. And some estimates suggest that as much as a third of all medical care in the country really doesn't need to be done, meaning it's done, it costs a lot of money, but it doesn't really provide any benefit to patients. And when you look at the big picture, if that's true, or even if it's partly true, if we could save some of those resources, some of those expenditures to help folks in the United States who are not getting enough care, as opposed to folks who arguably are getting too much care, well, you know, then we might get a little closer to having a more rational, fair way to take care of the entire country's population.
We are visiting with Dr. Brendan Riley. Dr. Riley is the author of the book, One Doctor, Close Calls, Cold Cases, and the Mysteries of Medicine. It's a narrative of the doctor's experience as a physician, and he takes you through his rounds. He talks with the patients. He talks with his colleagues, and he tells you also a little bit about, you know, what he's feeling also, because he's taking care of his elderly parents at the same time. There are two patients in the book that come to mind. They're both immigrants. One is a Croatian, and the other one is Russian. Would you mind telling us a little bit about these patients?
Sure. The gentleman from Croatia, and by the way, when I was writing about these patients, I had to change some of the details because, you know, it's important to protect the patient's privacy. I don't want to come across as, you know, being voyeuristic or something. So this gentleman wasn't actually from Croatia, but he was from a country right near there. Let me leave it at that.
Okay.
But this was a gentleman who, and, you know, New York is a place where a lot of foreigners come. This fellow happened to be visiting a granddaughter in Manhattan. When he got sick, he started bleeding from his bladder and had to come into the hospital at our place. And to make a long story short, he wound up having bladder cancer that had spread to the bones in his hip. And that's something that we can't cure. We can provide some treatment, but we can't cure it. And the remarkable thing to me was that that was exactly what was wrong with my own father. And so he's one example of how during that brief period of time that the book is about, I was on the one hand taking care of this lovely man from, well, let's say Croatia, who had exactly the same problem as my father had, and yet my patient wanted everything done. And so he planned to go through every possible kind of treatment, knowing that it could never cure him. You know, it could help him, but it couldn't cure him. While at the same time, my father, who, even though he was elderly, he was still sharp mentally, and he was a former physician, so he knew a little bit about these things, he had decided just the opposite. And so the gentleman from Croatia was interesting because he raised all kinds of questions about, you know, how much is too much care for folks who have essentially an incurable illness, and at the same time raising these symmetries with the care of my father. At the same time in the hospital is a woman from Russia, Russian-speaking, and so I had great difficulty communicating her, not just because I don't speak Russian, but because she also had a form of mental illness, probably schizophrenia, which made her mute. So she never spoke at all. And yet, in addition to the language barrier and the fact that she wouldn't speak to anyone, she had a very serious illness that required a lot of complicated care. And for that reason, we had to deal with her family to make a lot of these decisions rather than herself, because she, even though she was awake and alert, she wouldn't talk to us. And this is in spite of trying to give her the best psychiatric care we could at the same time. And she's an example of how the family often complicates treatment decisions that doctors and patients make, because in her case, what we were dealing with was three sons, their wives, and the patient's father. And trying to make decisions with so many different people is a little bit like herding cats, you know, because they never or hardly ever agree completely with each other. And you have to kind of figure out, okay, what are we doing here, when it is actually a situation where it's the family that has to make the decision and not the patient.
We're visiting with Dr. Brendan Riley. Dr. Riley is the author of the book One Doctor, Close Calls, Cold Cases, and the Mysteries of Medicine. Dr. Riley, well, you talked earlier about the fact that, you know, there no longer, or it doesn't exist as much, that patient-doctor relation as we used to have before. And in one of those incidents, you bring it up in your book as well, when you're talking, and I think it's also this woman who we're going to say is from Russia, when she asks who's going to take care of her, and you said you are. And she can't believe it, because she goes, you're not going to work on a Saturday, you're going on a trip, you're going somewhere. She couldn't believe that.
Yeah, well, that gets back to what I mentioned a little bit before about how now we have teams of doctors taking care of patients. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that, because, you know, now often patients in the hospital are a lot more complicated and a lot sicker than patients used to be, even in my own lifetime, long ago back in the hospital. And for that reason, these folks need doctors 24/7 in the hospital. And, you know, doctors have to sleep too. And so there's always going to be times when you have to hand off the patient from one doctor to another. Increasingly, what's happening in the nation's hospitals, and maybe even more so in the big teaching hospitals, which is where I've worked, is that so you have these teams of doctors who are doing the very best they can to help patients, but then they go home and another team takes over. And sometimes these changes of shifts happen as many as three times a day. And many patients are confused by this, and they often wonder, well, who is my doctor? Who's taking care of me? It looks like I've got 20 different ones. So a lot of what's happening today in teaching hospitals is trying to learn how to do better about not just making sure that the doctors all know what's going on as they change shifts, but also trying to reassure the patient and make sure that the patient feels confident that their needs are being addressed by all these different folks who seem to show up night and day. It's a difficult problem. It's an important problem. We're making progress, but we still got a ways to go.
Getting back to that team issue and the fact that you have different rotations, the fact, I think you addressed that in your book, because when you're talking about this patient who you're looking at, and I can't remember his name right now, but he is a patient who has cancer, and his wife is, for the lack of a better word, being kind of pushy and trying to tell you what to do, and you understand that she's nervous, upset, but at one point you just have to calm her down. And you're trying to trace and find out, okay, who checked in this patient, who was here when he was brought in, etc. And that, along with dealing with the wife, in fact, even the patient at one point, and it kind of makes you as a reader or as a listener jump back and go, wow, where did he get that strength, when he yells at her and says, be quiet.
Yeah, well, of course, you know, the last thing you want to be doing is yelling at either patients or their family members. But this, I think, is another example of why in the book I also do the flashback to long ago when, in my case, patients who were in the hospital under my care were patients I knew outside the hospital, too. And so this kind of situation arose much less frequently a long time ago because the system was different. It wasn't like it is today where I'm the doctor in the hospital, the patient is admitted to the hospital. In this case, the patient was flown in by helicopter from about 100 miles away because we're a big teaching hospital. And so I don't know the patient or the family. And the wife of this patient, who loved her husband and was intensely loyal to him and had been through all kinds of difficult situations with him because the poor guy was dying of cancer, she didn't know me from Adam. And so part of her concern was to make sure that I knew what I was doing and whether I knew enough to try to help take care of this patient and make sure all the right specialists saw him and all that stuff. So I had a lot of sympathy for the fact that she was basically standing up for her husband and fighting for him. But, you know, in these emotional situations, sometimes you go over the deep end a little bit. In this case, she did a little bit. And maybe I did, too. But that's part of the real life of doctoring and part of the reason I wanted to write about it.
When the husband yells at his wife, I think he's tired as well. And he wants to let her know, it's okay. I know you're trying the best, but I've had enough. I'm tired.
Yeah, I mean, he was a fellow, and it was a very sad situation because he was a relatively young guy. He was only about 50. He had young kids. But he was a guy who had received the best treatment you can receive for his kind of cancer. He'd been not just to our own hospital, but to several other very, very famous hospitals trying to get, you know, different opinions from different doctors and different treatments. So he'd really been through the ringer. He'd tried everything, and sadly, it hadn't worked, and the poor guy was dying. And I knew that, but his wife, well, if she knew it, you know, she didn't want to know it, and she didn't want that to be true. And for me, it was a very emotional situation when the patient himself, in my presence, said to his wife, you know, I've tried my best. I can't try anymore. It's time for me to die. It's, especially when you see that with folks who you don't know. That's a very emotional thing to go through.
We're visiting with Dr. Brendan Riley. Dr. Riley is the author of the book One Doctor, Close Calls, Cold Cases, and the Mysteries of Medicine. Dr. Riley, as you mentioned, working in teams, sometimes, and I think it's become a thing not just in medicine but in school as well, where people are trying to work in teams. Some people like it, some people don't. However, I mean, that's the status of the situation. And in one instance, Tina and Chris are with you, and they're looking at as its patient, and I believe Tina says, well, I don't see any peripheral signs of an endocarditis. Do you? And so you have to compare, okay, what you know, what they know. And then, as you mentioned in one part of the book, you should have all these things stored in the back of your head like a computer and then all of a sudden recall them.
Yeah, well, just to let your listeners understand, Tina and Chris in this case are residents. They're not, you know, they're not medical students. They're not interns. They're residents. They're very fine young doctors, but they're still learning. Just like, you know, I'm still learning and I've been doing this for a long time. We're all still learning. But this is an example where I think it's absolutely critical that the senior doctor, in this case me, have spent enough time with the patient, examined the patient carefully enough so that I have a pretty good handle on what's going on, and that I do that independently from the younger doctors, so that when the younger doctors examine the patient and try to understand what's wrong, what the diagnosis is, and what to do about it, then we get a chance to compare notes, the junior doctor with the senior doctor. Now, because sometimes the junior doctor is right on, and I agree with absolutely everything they say, and I say, great job, let's do that. But other times, I may have found things that they didn't find that are important, and sometimes they find things that I don't find that are important. So the whole benefit of having a team for the patient is that it actually should be better for the patient to have more doctors who may see different things and find some things that others miss, but none of that helps if each one isn't doing his own job independently and then comparing notes. And unfortunately, what happens in some hospitals today is that that really doesn't happen. The junior doctors do their things and they decide what they think they want to do, and the senior doctor just listens and says, yeah, okay, that sounds right. But the senior doctor doesn't necessarily know enough from his own direct observation of the patient to be able to criticize or change what the junior doctors think. So a little bit of the book is about what's involved in trying to supervise junior doctors how to try to teach them in a good way. And it's, as the book tries to make clear, that's a very time-consuming thing to do because you've got to do all the grunt work yourself and then compare your grunt work with theirs.
And I would imagine, despite all the technology and all the advances we've made in medicine, as you mentioned earlier, you have to get down to the basics. I mean, whether somebody earns $500,000 a year or they make $15,000 a year, they all have the same body, same kidneys, same organs, and somebody may be sick. But when it comes down to the basics, that's what they have to go before all the technology, correct?
Yeah, that's true. But in addition, I think one of the fascinating things about medicine, especially when you've been doing it for a long time, and I've been doing it for about 40 years, is a long time ago, so much of what doctors did and how they made diagnoses were based entirely on talking to the patient in detail, taking history, trying to understand the illness, and then examining them very carefully in a physical examination, you know, not just listening to their heart, but looking in their eyes and doing a neurological exam and all that stuff. Today, we have such powerful diagnostic technology that often that drives the process, so much so that, as many of your listeners probably know, often if they get sick or go into an emergency room or something, sometimes the first thing the doctors do is order a CAT scan or some fancy test. Without necessarily having done what I call the grunt work, which is talking to the patient in detail and performing a good examination. And so one of the fascinating things that's happening now is we're trying to figure out, so in what circumstances is it really important to keep doing it the old-fashioned way, you know, the old way of listening and talking and using a stethoscope and all that stuff, and in what situations is it smarter to just go right ahead to the fancy technology and do that first? And like a lot of things in medicine, of course, the answer is it depends on the situation. But often patients don't know why decisions are made the way they're made and why sometimes they kind of get the short end of the stick and don't get much of the doctor's time and instead get put in the CAT scan machine, whereas in other times the opposite is done. And like a lot of other things today, this is tricky because this is evolving and we're still trying to figure out what is the best way under certain conditions?
Well, Doctor, we want to thank you very much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to be with us. And we're so thankful that despite the technology, we're still able to talk one-on-one and have a conversation. And we enjoyed it very much. Thank you very much.
Well, thanks. I enjoyed it, too.
We've been visiting with Dr. Brendan Riley. Dr. Riley is the author of the book, One Doctor, Close Calls, Cold Cases, and the Mysteries of Medicine. Perspectives is taped and produced at the KTP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer, Norma Martinez. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Luis Sainz.